This is Brian Cambria with news for the KVNF listening area, Wednesday, June 13, 2012. The High Park fire near Fort Collins has burned more than 43,000 acres and taken one life, and is already one of the worst in Colorado history. Some evacuees started returning to their homes yesterday, but many areas remain under mandatory evacuation orders. The general evacuation area runs west of Horsetooth Reservoir, north of Masonville, east of Pennock Pass, and south of Highway 14. Additional evacuation areas include the area north of Highway 14 from Hewlett Gulch to 287 and north to Eagle's Nest. The Denver Post reports that yesterday a Larimer County official told residents of Stout, a very small community south of Horsetooth Reservoir, that they would have access to their homes afternoon. Evacuees from Bonner Creek area might be allowed back today. Meanwhile, new evacuation orders were issued for the Pingree Park Road area. The Post reports that the fire is still very active, splintering and spotting and running off in different directions, and as we heard, it's about 10% contained. Yesterday, Governor Hickenlooper signed an executive order formally authorizing the use of National Guard troops to assist with the fire, as well as allocating $20 million to the state's Disaster Emergency Fund to pay for firefighting efforts related to the fire. This was a formal activation of something that actually went into effect over the weekend. National Guardsmen have been activated to monitor checkpoints and control access. Colorado Army National Guard air crews dropped more than 5,000 gallons of water on the fire on Monday. Additional air crews from the Kansas and Nebraska National Guard are en route and are expected to start fighting fires today. Two additional Black Hawk helicopters are also expected to arrive today, joining three others already in place. And a few locals are heading out to fight the fire as well. Yesterday, the Hotchkiss Fire Protection District posted on its Facebook page that a Hotchkiss engine and four firefighters had been dispatched to the fire. And according to a release from the White House press office, President Obama called Governor Hickenlooper from Baltimore yesterday to get an update on the ongoing wildfire response. He also expressed condolences about the loss of life as a result of the wildfires and the extensive damage to homes and other structures. The president underscored that the administration is already making personnel, equipment, and federal grants available to support the response in Colorado and stands ready to provide additional resources should they be needed. According to a release from the United States Department of Agriculture, there are currently 19 active large fires burning in 9 states. The Forest Service has mobilized 4,500 firefighters and 8 additional air tankers to help suppress and contain the fires, bringing the total air fleet up to 17. The agency notes that, to date, the season has been somewhat below average, meaning that there are still additional federal resources if they become necessary. In a related story, the National Cooperative Forest Fire Prevention Program Committee has selected the Western Region Wildfire Council to receive a Smoky Bear Award certificate for their service to wildfire prevention. According to a release, the award is based on the organization's leadership in promoting wildfire mitigation and prevention education in communities across the region they serve. The Smoky Bear Awards are the highest national honor one can receive for outstanding work and significant program impact in wildfire prevention. The certificate and plaque will be presented to the West Region Wildfire Council tomorrow by the acting forest supervisor of the Grand Mesa, Uncompahgre, and Gunnison National Forest. Forests across the western United States have been decimated by a tiny insect no larger than a grain of rice. In Colorado, the hardest hit state, the mountain pine beetle has infected more than 6 million acres. Now scientists are studying the correlation between forest fires and the beetle, and what they found conflicts with conventional wisdom. Some scientists say diseased forests may in fact be less flammable than healthy ones. From Aspen Public Radio, Marcy Krivenin reports.
The forest high above Aspen is alive with the sounds of bugs, birds, and leaves rustling in the wind. But in certain pockets, death is palpable.
You know, there's some red and dead. So that's probably a year to 2 years ago when they were attacked.
City of Aspen forester Chris Foreman points out lodgepole pines twisted and dried up, evidence of a pine beetle attack. The beetle bores into the bark, lays eggs, and eventually cuts off the tree's water supply. Infected trees turn from a healthy green to red and ultimately to gray when needles fall off and drop to the ground. This transition can take a decade, and initially the tree tries to fight off the beetle.
Here are the classic pitch tubes where the adult beetles chewed into the tree, and the pitch tubes is the tree's response, trying to throw them out.
Foreman points to small popcorn-like bulbs dotting a diseased tree from top to bottom. The tree secreted this substance in an effort to fight the beetle. It didn't work. Normally, this kind of chemical defense works, but dry and warm conditions over the last 30 years have weakened pine trees across the West, making them more vulnerable to the beetle.
When you look at a forest that has been hit by beetles, it looks like there's a tremendous increase in fuel because of all the dead trees. And so you immediately think that the fire risk must go up.
That's Professor Bill Ramey, who teaches forest and fire ecology at Colorado State University. It's widely thought dried-up beetle-kill forests become tinder boxes just waiting for a spark to ignite forest fires. Ramey says that's not actually the case. In fact, says Ramey, healthy green forests can be more flammable.
I think the beetles actually reduce the flammability of the forest. As soon as they drop the needles, the fire risk is reduced.
That's the detail to remember. When the trees drop their needles, they're less flammable than a green tree. It's because hot, fast-moving fires typically burn at the tops of forests, jumping from leafy treetop to treetop. So if the tree's needles are missing, there's nothing left to carry the fire, making a fire less likely. Again, Ramey.
It's just like in a campfire. You can't put a match to a big log and have it start to burn. You've got to have the little stuff to get the fire started. And so once all those needles fall from the trees, the small stuff is gone. And it's really difficult to ignite those big dead stems.
In a future where larger fires are more likely because of climate change, Ramey says the beetles may have actually done some good, decreasing the fire risk on millions of acres of forests. Not everyone agrees.
I don't see any time during that period where that's the case.
Matt Jolly, a research ecologist with the Forest Service, disputes Ramey's idea of less flammability in beetle kill stands. He says beetle kill trees will always be more flammable than green trees because they lack moisture everywhere in their trunk, bark, and needles.
After an attack, the only thing that the attack stimulates is creating fuels that are more flammable, either by changing its chemistry, moisture content.
Recently, Jolly led a study on the flammability of beetle-killed trees before they drop needles, when they're most flammable, in the so-called red stage, which can last a couple of years or more. Jolly is convinced beetle-killed trees, with or without pine needles, are far more flammable and dangerous than green trees that haven't been infected by the beetle. Whether beetle-infected trees lead to stronger, potentially deadlier wildfires is still unclear, Jolly admits. He says more study will be needed because the answer could well impact how future fires are fought.
I think that it already has fire managers rethinking how they fight fire and where they put people.
Back in the forest above Aspen, a woodpecker digs into the bark of a dead, diseased tree. City of Aspen forester Chris Foreman says the beetles are native and part of the life cycle of the lodgepole pine forest. He says the look of forests will change in the future as temperatures climb and droughts lengthen. But these are hardy ecosystems adapting to change.
You know, it's a tough thing to see dead trees, but it's not all doom and gloom. You know, this is a change in our forests in the West. You know, and our kids and grandkids and great-grandkids are going to be able to see the process of what comes next.
In this particularly dry year, forest and fire experts will be keeping a close eye on diseased forests, hoping to find a clearer answer to the probability of fires there. For Rocky Mountain Community Radio, I'm Marcy Grevenen.
Changing gears now. An industry organization has said proposed federal regulations of hydraulic fracturing could cost Americans more than $1.6 billion annually, prompting an environmental group to call it money well spent. According to the Grand Junction Daily Sentinel, the Western Energy Alliance on Tuesday said the proposed rule, quote, will impose a cost to society of at least $1.499 billion and as high as $1.615 billion annually. The alliance said these costs are unnecessary because states already regulate hydraulic fracturing and there have been no incidents of contamination from fracturing. The Energy Alliance cited a study by an economics firm which concluded that the Bureau of Land Management's proposed rule would divert company resources away from energy development and economic growth into complying with federal rules that replicate state regulation. The National Wildlife Federation, however, said the practice is a threat on several levels. Kate Zimmerman, Public Lands Policy Director for the National Wildlife Federation, said, quote, costs imposed by federal fracking rules aren't a cost to society. They're a cost of doing business by an industry that counts its profits in the billions of dollars. The cost to society of failing to regulate fracking, of not protecting our water, air, and wildlife, are high. The proposed regulation would require disclosure of the chemicals used in the process once the company has completed drilling. Companies have pushed back against the rule, saying that the composition of the fracturing fluids is proprietary. In Colorado, companies post the composition of fluids on fracfocus.org, a joint project of the Groundwater Protection Council and the Interstate Oil and Gas Compact Commission. The proposed rule would affect drilling on the 700 million acres of public land administered by the BLM and 56 million acres of Indian lands. The proposed sandhill crane hunting season in northwest Colorado has been pulled off the table for now. At a meeting last week in Craig, Colorado Parks and Wildlife staff told the commission they were postponing the decision on the proposal, which would allow limited hunting of the birds in Rout and Moffat counties. Jim Haskins from Parks and Wildlife says that in response to public comment at the May meeting, the staff decided they needed more time to gauge public sentiment about the proposal. In addition, the commission will be reduced from 16 to 11 members in July and likely change members. That's part of the merger of the two state agencies, Division of Wildlife and State Parks, which began last year. Haskins said staff determined it wouldn't be fair to saddle new commission members with a controversial proposal like this. Local birder and sandhill crane enthusiast Evie Horn maintains that the population numbers of the commission is using are much higher than what she and Fish and Wildlife biologists have recorded for the same period. She presented her opposition to the proposal, along with about 10 others, at the May meeting. But Haskins says that the biology and population numbers are not up for debate among the agency staff and commission. The draft proposal would allow for about 40 hunting licenses for the birds in Rout and Moffat counties. The birds are already hunted in most other western states and even on Colorado's Front Range, though it is a different population than that on the western slope. Because of the delay in the decision, Haskins said sandhill cranes will not be hunted on the western slope this fall, but he expects that sportsmen's groups will bring the issue up again sometime in the near future. The Paradox Community Trust, a program of the Telluride Foundation, is seeking applications for low-interest loans and technical assistance from small businesses, nonprofit organizations, and local entrepreneurs with projects to promote economic development and job creation. On behalf of the trust, the foundation was recently awarded a USDA Rural Business Enterprise Grant, which the foundation doubled. The money will go toward a new initiative designed to grow the local economy by creating a revolving loan fund and providing business development assistance for startup, emerging, and small businesses within the Paradox Basin. The Paradox Basin consists of the western portions of San Miguel, Montrose, Dolores, and Montezuma counties. Interested businesses can either apply for a loan with some expert assistance or apply for only technical assistance with industry experts. Technical assistance areas may include feasibility studies, business plans, marketing analysis, and social enterprise models. Any small or emerging business with fewer than 50 employees and revenue under $1 million can apply for a loan between $5,000 and $20,000 to expand their business. Nonprofits seeking expert technical assistance to create jobs can also apply. The first round of applications will be due by July 16th. Applications can be found online at TellurideFoundation.org. Awards will be announced in early August. This concludes the morning newscast. For KVNF News, I'm Brian Cambria.